Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast, hosted by author Michael DeCamp and his family. Recorded in the Cutter's Notch studios, this podcast explores anything related to creativity. You'll find interviews with creative people, such as authors, artists, and performers, as well as friendly banter about any number of topics. Turn up the volume, listen, and catch up on what's happening in Cutter's Notch.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cutter's Notch podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Michael DeCamp, and I'm here with my other co-host,
Angela DeCamp.
And we are excited today because we have a returning guest, someone that...
Not only is she very talented and amazing, but she also has the best name in the world.
Jackson Brown. That's an awesome.
Angela Jackson Brown. We're so excited to have her back on the podcast. I think we've interviewed her previously and so.
Welcome, Angela.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Mike and Angela. I'm so excited.
We wanted to have Angela back because Angela has some really great news that has kind of transpired over the last few months. And we talked about having her back a while ago, but with the pandemic and everything, it's kind of been delayed. But
yeah,
we finally were able to get together and she gets to tell us all of her great news. I've been so happy for you, Angela, just to watch this thing unfold.
Yeah, we'll let her share some of that too. I don't want to give it all away.
We'll get into that in a few minutes. So we always start our episodes out with our creative moment of the episode. I'm actually getting to where I can say that without getting tongue-tied. I'm not sure what that was. That must have been my phone.
It's an exciting. It's the sound that we use for the creative moment of the week.
Yeah, there you go. My sound is off, but yeah. I don't know.
Anyway, Dad, what's your creative moment of this? Well, I guess of the episode.
My creative moment of the episode. Well, the last episode, which hasn't actually aired yet, I talked about the books I'm currently reading, mm-hmm. which is The Emperor of Nihon Job, which is a Ranger's Apprentice book, mm-hmm. and Angela Jackson Brown's book that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. I haven't finished either one of those, so I'm not going to share about those again, but I watched a movie the other night.
What did you watch?
I watched a movie called Tenet.
Oh, did you understand that? Apparently it's like complicated and people don't understand. I haven't seen it. I'm speaking as someone who hasn't watched it, but I feel like it was supposed to be kind of confusing for people.
Yeah. Yeah. It was on HBO. And I feel like that it's one of those movies that I really ought to see if there's a book by the same title and read the book, because it's a sci-fi techno futuristic thriller about time travel and technology from the future.
Anytime you throw in time travel, like it's so, for me, it feels like things are complicated because some rules apply in some worlds with different like time travel plots and some rules just don't in others.
Well, this one was kind of odd because it had like inverted movement. So like, you would go through this machine and then all of a sudden everything around you is happening.
So we're throwing physics into this as well, is what you're saying.
So it was definitely crazy, but it was entertaining, but boy, I tell you, I was exhausted from trying to figure out what they were doing, mm-hmm. and which timeline are they in and exactly what's happening at what point. But
maybe it's one you have to go back and rewatch.
But it was exciting. A lot of things blowing up and inverting blowing up, like blowing in. So they're blowing out imploding, and then they're blowing in and then
and like imploding.
Bullets are going out and then bullets are coming in. And it was kind of weird.
But sounds like a action packed movie.
Yeah, it was. It was. But I enjoyed it. Enjoyed it. Good flick. Nice. Once I sort of got the hang of it.
Really just excited to go back and watch movies in theaters. I am like really looking forward to that whenever we're able to.
Oh, such a concept. Such a concept.
Think about the popcorn smell. And
what about you, Angela DeCamp?
I guess my creative moment, I mean, other than the book we're about to discuss, so I'll save that for the discussion, but I also recently on Hulu, they released the final season of Shrill, which is a TV show with Aidy Bryant, and I'm sure a bunch of other really talented actors that I can't remember their names. But it's just a really good show. It's like 8 episodes per season. There's only 3 seasons and it kind of follows Aidy Bryant's character. And it's very, I feel like it's just a really I don't know, it covers a lot of really good stuff, but in or a lot of really challenging topics in a way that makes it feel like approachable and also really funny. And, you know, as someone who I wouldn't say I'm necessarily a plus size woman, but I'm not like a leaf in the wind either. So it's kind of like nice to watch a show with the main character who is a plus size woman and sort of like how she goes through the world and how she sees things. And, it's just, like I said, really funny. Adi Bryant, she's on SNL and everything, and she's just hilarious. I love her. So that's what I watched. I crammed it all in the final season yesterday. I watched the whole thing. So I'm all caught up, and I'm really sad because I feel like there's so much more that they could do, and they've just decided to end it after season three. So
don't you kind of hate that?
I mean, I do, but I'd much rather a creator stop when they know that it's time for them to stop than to try to keep making, like, beat a dead horse. Like, if they don't have any more material, why try to make something continue on? So
right. Well, how about you, Angela Jackson Brown? What do you have a creative moment to share with us this week?
Yes, I'm actually rereading a book called Hillbilly Queer by a friend of mine, J.R. Jameson. He and I are going to do a conversation in a few weeks, and I just wanted to refresh my memory of a few things in the book. And the reason why I love this book so much is because it gives me a window into really the soul of an individual I would think I had nothing in common with. So J.R. is talking about his relationship with his dad, Dave. Dave is a big-time Trump supporter, big-time Republican, and the book is set during the election year. And at that time, JR and his dad are going on a road trip to rural Missouri for Dave's 55th class reunion. So we get to see these two interact, these two men that are forced in a vehicle together, who have to come to terms with a lot of things that separate them. They meet people along the way who really push JR to figure out, how do I have a relationship with people I have nothing in common with? And I think it really affected me on such a personal level because I live in rural Indiana. Mm-hmm. I'm surrounded by people who have zero in common with me at first glance. But when you think of it in terms of, we love our families, we have friendships, you know, we're trying to make the best that we can in a community that's dying or dead. So it really put me in the mindset of trying to see the commonality between people rather than the differences. It doesn't always work, but I think this book does a good job of showing us that we have to at least try.
I love that.
What's the title of it again?
Called Hillbilly Queer.
Okay. And the author is J.R. Jameson?
J.R. Jameson. And he's local. He's Indiana, from Indiana as well. So another local writer.
All right. Well, very good. Well, now, Angela, the last time we interviewed you, I looked it up. Your previous interview with us was released on January the 4th of 2020, which means we must have interviewed you probably right before Christmas in 2019. Probably
back before things were
back before the pandemic.
Chaos and
yeah.
Oh yeah.
And back
before I got some really good news.
I know.
Well, I know. That's what I'm leading up to that. So you're like feeding right into it perfectly.
Perfect.
So, you know, at that time we were talking about your book, Drinking from a Bitter Cup, which I absolutely adored. But you have a new book out. So
tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely.
Well, do you want to know about the book, or do you want to know what led to the book being published?
Yes.
Let's do the whole story.
Do the whole shooting match.
Okay. Well, then in the beginning,
this is a really long story.
A really long story. Around the time that you and I were talking, I had a secret. I couldn't really share at that point what was going on, which was my agent was in negotiations with Thomas Nelson, an imprint of HarperCollins. And the negotiations were going back and forth. And then another publisher entered into the conversation for a brief period of time. Then they jumped out of the conversation. And so in January of 2020, I signed a two-book deal with Thomas Nelson. And the first book of that two-book deal came out April 13th, When Stars Rain Down.
And that's the book Angela finished. Angela DeCamp finished, and I'm 60% through.
I read it like in one day.
Oh my goodness.
You say you have a two book deal. Are you allowed to tell us anything about the other?
Well, the other book is scheduled to come. Well, so the other book is scheduled to come out next year, and we're in the process of talking to them about two other books because When Stars Rain Down has done well.
Yay.
So everybody's in the mood to talk. So we figure we should talk now while things are looking great.
Oh, absolutely.
But the next book coming out, it still has characters from When Stars Rain Down, but it's not a true sequel in that the main characters of When Stars Rain Down will not play a role in the sequel, which is based on a minor character who was the best friend of Jimmy Earl Ketchum, one of the characters in When Stars Rain Down. This guy is a politician, so I am really bumping up against history. We'll see President Truman make an appearance. We'll see a number of politicians like Strom Thurmond who will make an appearance. So I'm really going deep into historical fiction with this particular book. And it's been exciting because I'm a history buff, so I love anytime I can make fiction and history do a dance with each other.
Yeah, no, I loved that. And honestly felt like when Parsons, which is the town that you described, it felt like a real place to me. Like I really felt like I was there. And so I'm really excited to hear you say that you're kind of continuing on in that area because, clearly I enjoyed it. So that's really exciting to hear.
Did you?
Yeah.
You
know,
I've been intrigued with historical fiction and that genre of work. And I've, in the back of my mind, I've got a project that I'm kind of toying around with. I even started with a little bit, which is kind of a history of my mother's life, which goes back to around 30s and 1940s. But I'm a little bit intimidated because I got general concepts, but getting the details, the day-to-day life from that time period seems very daunting.
Well, maybe we should back up.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about like what this book is, what it's about, and then maybe we can get more into that nitty gritty.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good idea.
Absolutely. Well, When Stars Rain Down is, I would say it's a coming of age story. It's about a young black girl who lives in a fictional town called Parsons, Georgia. It's set in 1936 and it's during the summer. It's shortly after the Great Depression. So people are still struggling in this community to bounce back from one of the most, you know, terrible financial times of our history, and also dealing with the residual effects still of Reconstruction. You know, race relations are at its, you know, I won't say it was at its worst, but it was pretty bad at this particular time. So young Opal is dealing with growing up and also dealing with the racial tension that's existing in her town. And it all sort of comes to head at the annual Founders Day picnic, where everybody in the community, regardless of their ethnicity, always comes together this one time during the year to, have picnics and play ball together. And so this weekend is really the culmination of a lot of repressed anger that sort of comes to light during this time.
It's really interesting too that you chose to make that particular day of everyone coming together also be sort of a highlight of the divisions too.
Absolutely. I think one thing that I wanted to illustrate is just, you know, how thin the line is between getting along with each other and not, showing common courtesy to each other and not. And the interesting thing was that I was writing all of this during, for me, one of the most volatile times in history that I've lived through. And so to have to be in this fictional world where different cultures and different backgrounds are colliding, and to also see that happening in the world that I'm living in was very surreal.
Well, before I dig into that historical context thing I started to ask you about, I I wanted to raise another thing. One of the things I've noticed, you know, like, say I'm only 60% through the story, so I haven't reached that
culminational day yet
in the storyline yet. I think right now Opal's on her way to Atlanta, so for the ball game.
Don't give away any secrets.
That's not a big deal.
I'm just saying.
But at any rate, one of the things I've noticed so far in the story, Angela, and maybe you could share your thoughts on this, but one of the things I notice is that in your discussion of the race relations between like Opal and Jimmy Earl and some of the other characters that were, they, or Lori Beth, you know,
I don't want to talk about her.
They
keep going.
Well, it seems like in some way, and of course I don't know the whole story, so I don't know what unfolds after where I'm at, but it seems a lot of times there's this disconnect between the white folks and the black folks. They just don't really understand. They're trying to be kind, but their kindness is actually hurtful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I found that to be just an you portrayed that so intriguingly well.
I think maybe that's why it's like, oh, why I had that reaction, because I really see myself in that role in my worst, like my well-intended but poorly impactful version of myself. So yeah, that I thought that was, gosh, well, it was well captured, but it made me uncomfortable because it's like, gosh, I'm face to face with this now.
Yeah. It just makes, you know, we think about that, really hasn't changed to this day. I mean, we still don't really understand each other very well, I don't think. Is that a fair statement, Angela, do you think?
It's absolutely a fair statement. It was, you know, I try to sometimes work through the things that I'm going through the things that I write. And Lori Beth is very indicative of a lot of people that I have encountered probably over the last 4 or 5 years who truly were trying to be allies, trying to be mindful of the space they occupy, trying to be helpful, but not realizing that sometimes in an effort to be helpful to another group of individuals, you rush in with your own agenda of what that help is supposed to look like. And so I wrote that particular scene on the same day that something very similar happened to me, you know, where someone decided on their own accord what I needed as opposed to just simply asking me. But we all do that. That's not a race thing. That's just a human thing that we, you know, some of us care so deeply that we just want to fix things. Mm-hmm. And everything can't be fixed. And I think that's the point that, I hope it's the point that readers will walk away with, is that sometimes the best way to be an ally is just to listen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut you off. No. It's hard over the phone.
And the best way for me sometimes to convey those things is through the writing. And so I was able to share that scene with the person who made me feel that way, and she got it. You know, she didn't get it before when we were talking about it. But when she read it and she was no longer the main character in the scene, Lori Beth was, it was like an epiphany.
Oh, wow. Mm. Well, that's what, I mean, I guess leading into that was, I've highlighted a few little passages, but one of the lines that you wrote in this book that I just thought I really connected with was, this is obviously out of context, but it's in relation to the Lori Beth. And it was, she reasoned with the innocence of someone who didn't know a thing about the world we both lived in. Her version of the world was all black and white, right and wrong. Mine was every shade of gray you could imagine, where right and wrong only existed for the whitest members of the world. And I just feel like, oh my gosh, that for me, that just hit me hard. I was like, yeah, like sometimes you can't afford to live in a world that is all black and white, you know, right and wrong. It's like we do live in a world where there are so many different, the context is so big. And yeah, it's just.
And, you know, sometimes like I will have people say to me, I don't see color, and I cringe. Because we absolutely see color. Mm-hmm. We also see differences that are visible to the naked eye. So to pretend like we don't. And I understand when people say that, what they're trying to say is that I don't see you any different than I see anyone else. But we live in a world where we are constantly bombarded with messages about different groups of people. And for us to not acknowledge that those messages have an effect on us would be, we're misleading ourselves, and mm-hmm. we're leading ourselves down the same rabbit holes that we've been going down for the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm.
Your characters have such depth, Angela, and I mean, they feel very real to me. You know, when I think of Opal and Cedric, Jimmy Earl, if I go back to drinking from a bitter cup, I think was the girl's name was Sylvia, right?
Yeah, Sylvia Butler.
Yeah, they feel so real to me. How do you develop them and give them such a sense of realness? How do you do that? What's your secret?
Wow. I spend months getting to know my characters before I ever sit down to write their stories. I go on a quest to find out everything I can possibly find out about them, so that by the time I'm sitting with them to write, and there's something I learned from hearing Toni Morrison talk about her approach to writing, that, you know, it's our obligation as writers to know not just the things that are going to be on the page, but the things that affect what's going to be on the page. You know, so I know things about Opal that never made it into the book, but helped me to see her more fully. And as her creator, it's my obligation to know more about her than I reveal to my readers anyway. You know, how can you be the creator of something yet you don't know it? And I say that to my students all the time. You know, I'll ask them simple questions. You know, what day of the week was your character born? Or what was the name of the hospital they were born in? Or how many hours was the mother in labor? And they all look at me like I'm crazy. And they're like, well, that doesn't have anything to do with the story. But I'm saying to them, it has absolutely everything to do with the story. Because until they're human to you, they'll never be human to the people who will read your work.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, when I think of that, I think about like the difference between like Kraft macaroni and cheese and like homemade real good macaroni and cheese. Like, you can tell the difference on somebody who takes the time and the effort to like flesh it out, and it's so much better and more satisfying.
Absolutely.
Well, let's dig into that historical thing. So I like I say, I'm in kind of intimidated by trying to write something that's so far before I existed. You know, I was born in the early 60s, and my mother's story begins really in the 20s and 30s and 40s, particularly in the 40s, the part I was going to write. It's like, how do I get that? How did you get such detail in your understanding of the historical nature of things, and in such a way that you could write such detail about it? What was your research like?
Oh my goodness, it was extensive. It was very much that when you're writing historical fiction, the historical time becomes another character. So the same level of labor that I put into getting to know the actual characters, I put in that same level of energy getting to know the historical time that my characters live, because it's not just a matter of getting dates and times and locations correct. I mean, that's a history paper. How do you get the details correct so that it feels authentic? And that authenticity is a journey. It's not something that you can sit and Google for a few minutes and feel like you know 1936, or in the case of the book I'm writing now, that I know the year 1948. I read books about, you know, the different historical people that I'm writing about. So, for example, I've been doing a lot of research on some African-American leaders like A. Philip Randolph, Mary McLeod Bethune, also looking at Adam Clayton Powell Jr., looking at the Kennedy family. And all of them play a role in the story that I'm telling, but it's not enough for me to just know the historical details about them. So, for example, with a character like Adam Clayton Powell Jr., I couldn't just read, you know, his notes from being in the House of Representatives. I needed to go deep and find out what kind of man he was, because mm-hmm. then I know how he's going to behave in certain circumstances. Like, for example, I know he smokes cigars and likes dark liquor, even though he's a pastor. I know that he's a showboat. I know that he loves the ladies. And so knowing all of those kind of details, it allows me to feel comfortable retelling a part of his history that never took place, because it's all fiction. He's having relationships with my fictional character, but I'm making sure that he's historically accurate for the type of man that he was. And that takes a lot, and it takes practice. It's not something that you can just come out of the gate doing. I say start with something short, you know, write a flash fiction story or write a short story and get the feel of what it's like to inhabit a time frame that's not your own, and then work yourself up to a book, because that's what I did.
Well, that's a great idea. Great idea. I think there's another aspect of your writing that I think you probably put an incredible amount of detail in, and I'd like to hear you talk about that a little bit. And that's your, the dialect, you know, as I'm reading, When Stars Rain Down, and as the characters are, you know, speaking back and forth to each other, it seemed to me that the dialect was very realistic for the time and the culture. How hard was that to get correct and get it done the way that you wanted it to be?
It wasn't as hard because I grew up in the South. So I know what that dialect sounds like. My father, he was born in the 1920s. So he would have been close to the age of Cedric and Opal. Mm. And so I listened to him speak, and his brothers and his sister and other elders in the family. So that dialect was clear to me. But when writing dialect, what we aren't interested in doing, what we shouldn't be interested in doing, is just making them sound ignorant. That's what a lot of people think about dialect, particularly Southern dialect, is just a bunch of ignorant people. But there's really a melodious tone to it that mm-hmm. is very difficult to mimic. You know, I didn't want to just, you know, split infinitives or have a bunch of misspelled words and try to pass that off as Southern dialect. That's not what it is. So it was really a conscious effort on my part to make sure that I captured the spirit of the dialect, but I wasn't mired down by the dialect. If that makes sense.
Yeah, very much so. Did you have a favorite character?
And you can't say Opal.
She can if she wants to.
Well, I'm adding another layer. You got a yes and me.
It is a difficult question because they really are. It's like your children. It's very difficult. Although, you know, some folks can easily say, no, this child is my favorite. I don't have any problem saying it. I love them all, but one of the characters that I had the most fun writing would have been Miss Lavinia.
Oh, I loved her. Actually, I have a question kind of related to that, which was what was the most difficult character for you to write?
He wasn't a main character, but Skeeter was definitely a difficult character to have to deal with his dialogue, to have to write, even as a secondary character, to have to write him was a very overwhelming process. And on the days that he was in a scene, I usually made sure I wrote those scenes early in the morning, and then I could take the rest of the day off to just, you know, take a shower and, you know, get him
goodness.
Off. He's definitely the kind of character who takes up the room when he's in it.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I have a feeling I'm going to see more of Skeeter before I get to the end of this book. So that's interesting. So Miss Lavinia was your favorite, and Skeeter was maybe the most difficult?
Definitely. He was difficult because usually, even when I have a character who's dark, I give them some redemption qualities, but I didn't really do that with him. Largely because he wasn't a secondary character who was important enough that he needed to be well-rounded. I think the most well-rounded I made him was the fact that he always took up for his cousin, Jimmy Earl, you know, as when they were children. So right. I guess you see his humanity in that way. But because the story is told through the eyes of Opal, she never would have seen that firsthand. Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, I think my favorite character might be Granny.
Yeah.
Miss Birdie. Yeah, I think I kind of like her a lot.
Yeah, she's the grandmother I never had, you know. And I do that a lot, you know. I'll create a character who represents something that I wish would have been in my life. And Grandma Birdie was definitely that person. Because I was adopted as a child, and I always imagined what would have happened if my maternal grandmother would have known that I was, you know, that I existed. Would she have fought for me the way Grandma Birdie fought for Opal? And I would like to believe that she would have. So that was sort of me putting her in this character the way that I imagine her in my head.
Yeah, I really enjoyed their relationship.
I like the uncles too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Now, the uncles were my uncles straight up. They just, my daddy, who adopted me, his brothers were my protectors. And they were the easiest characters to write because I put my uncles in the story.
Well, I was wondering if you had, you know, some inspiration for some of these characters. So your uncles were the inspiration for the uncles in the story, but. Did you have any other individuals that were inspirations for some of the other characters?
Dad, you were the inspiration for Skeeter.
Oh, yeah. Thanks a lot.
Just kidding.
Well, like, let's say, for example, the church. The church members that really represented the small country church that I attended. So all of the older people in the church, the pastor, his wife, those were, you know, remnants of people that I knew from my childhood. Miss Peggy, she was sort of a composite of all of the older white women from my community who were really nice, who, you know, my adopted mother was a domestic worker, and so were a number of my aunts, and I would often be with one of them when I would go to the homes that they would clean and cook and take care of the children. And the way Miss Peggy treated Opal was, in a lot of ways, how I was treated by some of the white women that my family members worked for. Not all of them, but some of them. And so I wanted to show a side of that world that, unfortunately, it's just not been shown. It's usually painted as a very adversarial relationship, and sometimes it is. But there's also the Miss Peggy's of the world who were still benefiting from systemic racism, but at the same time did the best that they could to try to, you know, be fair and to be caring and to not take advantage of the people who they were already taking advantage of just by virtue of having them as their workers.
Mm-hmm. Now, your stories provide it felt like a real inside look, a peek into kind of the historic day-to-day lives of Black Americans from that time period.
And I think it was really, like, complex and nuanced, too. I think a lot of times this kind of, like, genre, people simplify things a little, too much. And I felt like this one was, you know, in some ways it was a lot to chew on because it was so shades of gray.
Lots of layers.
Yeah.
Lots of layers. What do you want your readers to carry with them after they read your work? Anything in particular that you're hoping comes out of that?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping that they feel that they have, like what you just said, that they've been given a glimpse into a world that they maybe normally would not have seen. The Black community is no longer as monolithic as it was, if it ever was. But we definitely don't have the same experiences. People, you know, are all over the spectrum, and economics separates us all. So for me, it's in a way part history lesson, you know, part how do you connect with someone who has nothing in common with you? And what I hope is that a reader will walk away and see the similarities between them and an Opal, or them and a Jimmy Earl, or even them and a Lori Beth Parsons. Because you know, a lot of people have said to me, oh, I can't stand Lori Beth Carson. She's terrible. but that's part of the reaction that I expected. But I'm also hoping that as people have time to kind of digest everything and think back to the story, they'll take a few things into consideration. First, Lori Beth is young. She's naive. She's wealthy. She's never experienced life other than in a bubble. And for her to try to do something to deal with the situation that is beyond her capacity to understand, I think hopefully allows us to give her a bit of grace. You know, cause that's what I had to do with the friend that was proposing something that I knew was not going to be beneficial to me or anyone else. Mm-hmm. And I could either just write off her friendship, or I could say, let me educate you. And then after I educate you, if you still want to do something that we both, you've been told is not going to work, then I don't have anything else to offer to this conversation. So I'm hoping Lori Beth will grow on people after a while.
I would say, like, the reason that I have that adverse reaction to Lori Beth is that it just made me feel, it made me feel exposed, you know, like on my, you know, before I, not that I know anything really, but like before I really knew better and like, I could see myself behaving in that way. And it's like, oh no, like, oh, it's my word. Like I internally cringe. Cause I'm like, oh, I'm sure I've done stuff like that before.
But that's what literature is supposed to do. From in my mind, it's supposed to put a mirror in front of our faces.
I'm just waiting for the movie to come out. This is going to be awesome.
Well, I'll tell you what, never mind. This is, although the number, well, not the number one. One thing that's really stuck with me is eating peaches is going to be very different for me going forward in the future. Sorry, Dad, but
you're giving away something I haven't got to yet.
I think you've got to it. I just probably didn't linger with you like it did with me. Moving on.
Yeah, that was an interesting scene to write.
It was, but it felt like it's true to somebody coming of age too.
Yeah.
So
I saw the other day when you were talking about your books being displayed at Books a Million and how excited you were. So what are your feelings when you see your book displayed in a retail outlet like that? What's that like?
And where can we find them?
Oh my goodness. It's so surreal because with my first book, I didn't have that kind of platform because I published with a very small publisher. They didn't have those types of connections to get my book into a large chain. So everything that I did was grassroots. It was really word of mouth. It was individuals like you and Angela bringing me on, having me talk about my work. And with this book, they have those kind of connections. Their books automatically are going to be in bookstores. Now, not necessarily every bookstore, but we've had really good luck. The pre-press was great. So as a result, my book is starting on the 18th of May, my book will be in all Target stores. It's already making appearances in like the airport bookstores. And it's in all major bookstores that are still in operation. Now, some of the smaller bookstores, which I always encourage people, go to your small independent bookstores. I don't care if it's on the shelf or not. Order it through them, and they can get the book there within a matter of days. It's always good to help our local bookstores stay afloat because during this crisis, they were the ones that were keeping all of us authors going, even more so than the chain.
Mm-hmm. I usually try to give a plug in for our friend, Alicia at Irvington Books and Vinyl for that very thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And people can reach, Irvington Vinyl and Books from my webpage. And so even if you don't live in Indianapolis, Indiana, if you don't have a local bookstore in your community, you can order the book through her and it'll ship just like it would if it were coming from Amazon. And in fact, the people that ordered from her got their books before the people who ordered from Amazon.
Wow. Well, now you need to give everybody your website now.
Absolutely. My website is angelajacksonbrown.com.
That's pretty straightforward. Yeah. Is there a hyphen between the Jackson Brown, or is it just all run together? AngelaJacksonBrown.com.
AngelaJacksonBrown.com. No hyphens, no other things, but just my name.
Yeah, I'm going to go, and next time I'm in an airport, I'm going to go in the bookstore in the airport. I'm going to find your book, and I'm going to stand there, and I'm going to
take selfies.
I know her. I know her.
And people are going to be like, please escort him off the premises.
Yeah, no doubt.
But before they do that, take a quick selfie with you in the book.
Oh, of course. Right. Of course. Yeah, I bought it on my Kindle because I wanted to make sure I got it. You know, I was hoping to read it before we got done here. Angela actually got, she's got a paper copy.
I have
copy.
A hard copy, and I've got tabs and highlighted sections.
Yeah. So I'm going to have to buy the paper version
it's
also.
It's so beautiful. Put it on my shelf. That's the one thing I wanted to say, and I almost forgot. I just think the cover is gorgeous. I think it's such a beautiful blue with the orange and the, oh my goodness. Very well done cover.
Oh yeah. That was, the only thing that I said is I love a silhouette of Opal. And from there they went to this, and it was just, beautiful. The tweaks that I asked for were very, very simple tweaks. It's pretty much the same design that they showed me in the beginning, which is rare. When we did Drinking from a Bitter Cup, that cover, we went back and forth and back and forth for a few weeks before we got it right. But this was in a matter of days after I received it. I just knew this was the cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, no, it definitely, I think it encapsulates just the everything about this book. It just feels like it kind of anchors it.
Well, I love the title too. Mm-hmm. And I got I really kind of smiled. I just smiled when I got to the part of the story where the title was in the story. And I'm like, oh, this is sweet. This is great.
Yeah, that happened through the revision. That wasn't the original title when Stars Rain Down. So when they came up with the title, we all just loved it. But I had to go back and find ways so that it felt like the title was organically part of the story. So that came through revision, embedding that into the same, but then it made sense. So, I was able to do interesting things with the stars and all this kind of good stuff.
Oh, that's cool. All right, Angela, we've come to the portion of our recording.
Is it random question hour?
It's a random question time. And we got,
I'm going to pull out a random question for you and you'll just have to answer it.
Oh, so we're not going to give you a choice.
We never do. She's not here. So,
I know.
Now,
I'm not there. So I don't know that the question you asked me is even the question that you pulled.
I know.
You could just ask me anything.
I know.
I have a deck of cards here that I bought as a gift for the podcast, I suppose. We just have hundreds of random questions on it. So I'm going to pull one out here for you. But before I do, I really wanted to tell you that the last time we spoke, you were a big advocate for the Great British Baking Show. And I told you, I was like, I've never seen it. I've heard it's really good. But I wanted to let you know that I have consumed quite a bit of that show, the most recent season anyway. And I thought of you while I was watching. I was like, oh, this is exactly what she was talking about.
And I still watch it regularly.
It's a good show. It's very relaxing. All right, I've got a question here. Let me see. Okay. If you could be guaranteed an honest answer, what would you ask and to whom?
If I could be guaranteed an honest answer. Okay.
Sorry, that's a hard one.
I know it is a hard question because I'm trying to think what is something that I want to know that I don't. And I really don't have anything that's just looming over me. I think I probably would go as far back to the early 1600s when the first slave was brought to the United States. And I would ask that person, how do you live with yourself? Mm. How do you live with yourself knowing what you put into motion? Yeah. Because I'm always curious about people who do things that hurt other people intentionally. Like, what do you say to yourself that allows you to go to sleep at night? Because I get caught up on silly things that will keep me up at night. How do you do it when you've done terrible, awful, big things?
Made me think of the, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but the author of the song Amazing Grace. You know that story, Angela?
Should I Google this for you while you're...
I vaguely remember something happened to, was it to his child or something or to?
No.
Maybe that's a different one.
Angela DeCamp is looking up his name, but he...
John Newton.
He's
an Anglican clergyman, slave trader, and abolitionist.
Yeah. Oh. He started out early in his life as a slave trader on a ship carrying slaves from Africa. And wow. Later in life, he was broken by what all he had done.
Wow.
And ended up writing that song as a result.
Wow.
That kind of, it plays right into what you were just talking about.
Emotional.
That's a beautiful, powerful story of now that's redemption.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And then to bequeath us with a song that has led towards the redemption of so many people. Now, if there was, I don't know how the universe or the world works outside of the life that we are in now, but there would have to be an afterlife for this person that looks pretty good based on that action alone.
Yes. You know, if you, once you know his story and you go back and you read the lyrics to that song and you put it in that context, it kind of changes the whole perspective
real.
Of that song.
Well, you guys are more serious. I was over here. I was like, I'll ask my ex-boyfriend if he really cheated on me or not. You guys are like, oh, we're going to change the world.
X is the operative word. There's no reason to go back down that road again.
No, see, now, right. I wasn't going serious either. Angela Jackson Brown went serious.
I have to think of a really good one now.
I was going to ask President Biden if there really were aliens found in Roswell.
Oh, now that piques my curiosity. That's
interesting. Now I feel like actually maybe, oh, better yet. I'm going to ask who's somebody really wealthy? Pick somebody wealthy.
Warren Buffett.
I'll ask him for his PIN number, I guess.
And he'd have to give it to you.
It has to be an honest answer.
He would quickly find his phone and change it.
Not before I could get a couple out.
Oh,
but
my goodness.
Think now something, but this question, like me thinking about that, you telling me about the gentleman that wrote Amazing Grace, and now immediately I would like to write a historical fiction story that has him in it in some way. See, that's where the ideas come, just from random places that you never know, and all of a sudden you're hooked. So don't be surprised if you see a story from me sometime in the future.
Oh, that'd be so cool.
Well, I will definitely be reading it. I will definitely be reading that. So,
We're looking forward to your next book and the future ones that come after that as well. I'm really, there's so much, and I hate to keep going because I know that you're probably, Dad, you're probably winding down, but I was like, oh man, the way that the story ended when stars ran down, it's like there's so much left that you have to question. You know, there's like, there are things that are tied up and there are things that are left open. And I've been chewing on it. I went over to my sister's house and I just ranted all about it the other day. I was like, I can't believe this. And I want to know what's going to happen with this. So, I know I kind of talked myself into a corner here because there's not really a good segue out of that.
Well, I'll help you out. So whether she writes the answers to all those questions, she already knows the answers because she's developed all these characters fully. So all you got to do is sit down with Angela Jackson Brown and she can fill you in.
Sometimes I think the beauty of it is not you don't get those answers, you know, and I think that's something that's important to it's okay to not have those answers and think about it for yourself. So.
Yeah, it's all about timing and where to end the story, you know, where the person can be satisfied, if not have every answer, every question answered. You know, it's like, do you feel like you can leave these people and that they're going to be okay? They're going to figure it out. I think it's when we don't know that, when there's that uncertainty, that we want to keep going. to make sure they're going to be safe on the other side.
Mm-hmm. And in life, I mean, we just don't have an assurance of that in life. So
no, absolutely not.
That's right. All right.
Anyway,
well, I guess we should probably back to those aliens in Roswell.
Let's try to cheer. Getting dark again.
let's bring this down to a landing here. And Angela Jackson Brown, thank you so much again for joining us. For the listeners out there, go to AngelaJacksonBrown.com to find out all the details about all her works.
You can even Google her. She pops right up on Google.
Yeah, I'm sure she has her own author page on Amazon. I'm sure.
I do.
And, you know, that's another thing that you and I have in common. I am so happy for you. I was so excited when you announced your book deal. And then you start talking about the Target stores, all the Target stores, and then the Books a Million. And now they're going to be in airports. And it's just incredible to see your success. I'm so happy for you, and I appreciate you being a friend of the Cutter's Notch podcast.
Yeah,
so.
Thanks for remembering us little people down here.
Oh, my goodness. You look, I don't care. You guys call me up anytime. If it's between Oprah and you, guess who I'm going to choose?
You're
going
to go to Oprah.
Please choose Oprah.
Yes,
please choose Oprah.
Oprah. But before I got to know.
It's like, were we silent or were we silenced?
No, but you know what? It's always more fun and it's always more gratifying when people in your back door value what you do. It's great to have all those other folks too, but this means so much to me. And I thank you all for always thinking about me.
Oh, of course.
Absolutely.
Of course. I mean, ever since I first met you at Alicia's store.
And ever since I first met you in the dining room of my parents' house.
The dining room.
No, you were in the Cutter's Notch.
The Cutter's Notch studio. Sorry.
So, you know, I still remember meeting you at Alicia's store. I remember when we exchanged our first books and I gave you a copy of mine. You gave me a copy of yours. And then I ran into you again at the Indianapolis Public Library because we were both we were at an event there.
Nerds.
The Indiana Writers Award. I think it was that weekend or something.
Yes, I was part of the book signing. I was part of the new authors kind of expo.
I think I remember that.
So that was.
Angela, you just have such a great, authentic, genuine personality. Like, it's so easy to talk with you. And so it's always fun, even like over the phone. Sometimes this can be really challenging over the phone, but I feel like it was just great and easy to talk to you, just as usual.
Just talking to friends.
Yeah.
I try not to think about the listeners and just focus on the two of you. And that makes it much easier.
I like it when people focus on me. So.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. It's all about you, girl. Your name is Angela.
I know all Angelas are good. I've never met a bad Angela.
I'm going to start calling her Lori Beth, though.
Oh, how dare you?
Don't do it.
I'm going to start calling you Skeeter, if that's the case.
Well, it a minute ago.
I am. Well, so. You're bringing it out in me. No, I do want to say, too, if we are winding down, I want to make sure that we go ahead and thank Bill Whitehair for his effort on all the editing and everything on this, too, before I forget. I don't want to forget, because he does a lot of work for us.
Well, in the last episode, which hasn't aired yet, and you weren't on, unfortunately, I did forget. So we'll give Bill Whitehair a double thank you for his producing work. So thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah. Sorry you had to put up with the last episode. But
Yeah. Well, he hasn't even, as of this moment, hasn't seen it yet. But he
doesn't need to know. Yeah. And then I guess if anyone is listening and wants to rate us or review us online, you can do it. I don't think has anybody done it? Does anybody care about us?
No,
we live
cares.
Alone in this sad world and, you know, it's fine. No, I'm just kidding. But we are available to receive reviews and all of that.
If you want to email us, you can email me at michael@authormichaeldekamp.com.
And I would like to be left alone.
Well, if you tell me about it, I will tell Lori Beth about it.
How dare you? I'm just kidding. I'm on social media as well. You can DM me on Twitter, on Instagram. You just look up Angela DeCamp after you look up Angela Jackson Brown. And I'm another Angela out there in the world.
One of the other Angelas easily found on the internet.
Yes.
And, for those of you who are listening, if you're interested and you enjoyed this podcast, you can find out more details on the podcast by visiting my website, www.
Stop saying W.
I know, I'm supposed to say W.
W.
W. W. W. Oh. Author, MichaelDeCamp.com. And so while you're there, sign up for my newsletter. And you'll get a free short story, PDF, attached to an email.
The very detailed instructions that you're giving here.
I know. I'm sorry. I can't help it. Okay, folks. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Cutter's Notch Podcast.
The Cutter's Notch Podcast is available through most podcast listing providers. New episodes drop approximately twice a month. You can email Michael at authormichaeldecamp@gmail.com. Michael DeCamp is the author of two novels, Abandoned Hope, Cutter's Notch Book 1, and Nozomi's Battle, Cutter's Notch Book 2, a collection of short stories entitled Cutter's Notch Interludes, and one nonfiction Christian devotional book entitled Loving Out Loud, Learning to Love in a Hate-Filled World. All books can be found on Amazon or ordered from your local bookseller. Please join us again on the next episode of the Cutter's Notch Podcast.